Session number 21116, Wheel 1.
Sid Nuttall, Rail 1. Where were you born, please?
I was born in Halifax, Yorkshire.
Which year was this?
It was the in October 1919, 21st of October.
Did your parents come from Halifax?
Yes, both born and bred in Halifax.
What did your father do for a living?
My father, he was an engineering in the brass industry. He made fittings, brass fittings for joints and that and the like.
And did you grow up and have your schooling in Halifax?
Yes.
Which school did you go to?
I was at one school only, was the Battington Road School. Battington Road School, Halifax, both the junior and the senior.
How old were you when you finished?
14 years.
Did you get a job?
Yes, I was apprentice motor engineer.
Did you join TA before the war?
No, not in TA. I joined the reserve before the war, but not the TA.
Can you tell me about joining the reserve, please?
Mm-hmm. 1938, there'd been more or less a bit of a crisis, and it was generally understood that a war coming up. The army suddenly realised that they had to have a lot of transport. They also realised they had very little, few mechanical men in the regular army. They formed a new reserve, Supplementary Sea Reserve. This was a reserve for tradesmen. There was no camp duties, there was no training, there was no uniforms given out, but we would be the first people to be called up and put into the trade when and if they required us. We were supposed to get a bounty. I think the bounty was about £100 end of the first year. I never got it. The war started before then.
Did you hear Neville Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
Yes.
Under what circumstances?
I heard it. I was being called up into the army then. I was down in Portsmouth in the ROC depot there, and we heard it on a radio. That would be the first of September, Sunday.
How did you feel about the news?
I wasn't surprised. Everybody was expecting it.
What happened to you next?
Nothing much. It was the most awkward spot ever. 14,000 of us arrived into the depot at Hilsey in 3 days. Most of them were supplementary sea reservists, or there were some regular army reservists that had finished their time, gone on to the army reserve and were called back. The depot wasn't big enough, they hadn't enough facilities to feed us even. They started serving breakfast at about 5 o'clock in the morning, were still serving it at 10 o'clock in the morning. They started serving lunch at 10:30 and were still serving it at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Then they started serving tea. It was one long round of going for meals. They hadn't enough people to train us. I wasn't even taught to salute or march or anything at all. No military training. We were given rifles, bayonets, uniforms and inoculations. And then we just hang around until such time as we got posted out to units. It was a mess.
And this was at Hilsey?
At Hilsey, barracks at Portsmouth.
What happened next?
Eventually, we was posted out to various units up and down the place. I myself was sent to 14th Army Field Workshops, ROC. This was a TA unit from the Midlands. The CO was the proprietor of a transport company. All the sergeants were drivers in the transport company. The, as I said previously, the sergeants the sergeants and sergeant majors were all drivers in his transport company. They were drivers, not mechanics. And so, although we had approximately 100 mechanics, very few of them were from that company. We formed up just outside Farnborough, near Aldershot, where the kit had started to arrive, and we were sent, the fitters, the vehicle mechanics, were sent down to Aldershot for trait testing. About 100 of us, we were told that people with over 90% would be classified as class 1, 80% class 2, 70% class 3, and below that would be failed. Out of the 100 of us, there was two of us passed first class, myself and also another chap lad of my own age that come from Bradford. I'm not saying we was the best mechanics, but we was but one of the very few that had ever done any theory. Because in those days, a motor mechanic was a motor mechanic. He worked with those. And he didn't know much theory.
With his hands.
I'd been going to the technical college in evenings, and I had the theory training, which went with the mechanical, and so I got first class trade. I was 19 then. Eventually, we were kitted up, and we moved down to the south, near the south coast, in a I should say a large estate. And from there, we eventually went down to Southampton in convoy, and took a ferry from Southampton to France. The place we went was where
Cherbourg.
Cherbourg it was, that's right. Cherbourg, where we tied up onto the quay that the big transatlantic liners normally come at. During this move, I was made a dispatch rider, because I had a motorcycle of my own. It was not very nice. It was winter. It was getting towards the end of the year. We had motorcycles, which was BSA, a very old thing. We had no gauntlets, no crash helmets, no riding boots, anything of that nature. We just had our own woolly gloves, and we had to ride in a steel helmet, which was hopeless because it used to bounce up and down all the time. But that's all the kit they had. All the kit they had. Everything was in short supply. We made the trip all right, without much trouble to Southampton. I fell off once on ice and finished up underneath a tank. But luckily, the tank was parked at the time. The tank was going to the same place as we were going, and it was parked up, and I slid right underneath it. We arrived in Cherbourg, onto the dockside. We eventually unloaded the kit. We leaguered up somewhere outside the town, which is like a small park, until we got all the vehicles off. And then we formed up a convoy going up to the northern France to take up our place in the army up there. This was, again, a horrible journey. The very, very icy. The army didn't have antifreeze in those days, so every vehicle had got to be drained down of water every night and filled again in the morning. Otherwise, the block froze up and would crack. We had some comma vehicles, wagons, and we had great trouble with them. The comma had a water pump that was situated very low down in the vehicle. It was driven by a connection to the engine that was simply a rubber tube held together by bolts. Where we could drain the water down, we could drain the water down out of the engine, but the water was left in this water pump. So every night it froze. The following morning, if they tried to start the engine, it just tore this rubber drive in two pieces. So they had to cut another piece of rubber hose and bolt it in. We had this trouble every night. We carried on. We got up to our place. It was in a, they call it a chateau. It was a rather broken old, down old house on the edge of a fairly main road. We moved in, we set up shop. We then started to try to get together to work as a working unit. We had no customers at that time because we yet hadn't been taken into the thing properly. But the first job that came up, you probably heard of the Maginot Line, which was the French big defensive position. Well, as a token gesture, one infantry brigade went to serve in the Maginot Line at a time. They was in for so many weeks, withdrew, and another brigade came in. And just to give them a taste of the Maginot Line. It was the time of the phony war. Nobody was shooting at anybody else. And our workshop was tasked with providing a small unit to work with these incoming teams in the Maginot Line. So we went into the Maginot Line.
This was the 14th workshop?
The 14th Army Field Workshop, yeah, that's right. Just a detachment of us. There was not many of us, just a small detachment. Quite interesting, we went down into a tunnel into Maginot Line. A lot of it was underground. But we came out, you could come out in front of it, and it was fairly open between us and the Germans. We could actually see them, probably about 400 or 500 yards away. They were putting up fortifications, and so was we. The brigade that came in was making fortifications, and the other people doing the same, and we just ignored each other. The only casualty we had was when a British officer decided to do a one-man reconnaissance. Nobody told him to. He went down to have a look at the Germans, and there was a remains of a railway line in between the two of us, and he crossed that and they shot him, and that was at night. He was the only casualty I heard from. We had one of our water carts. Water was carried in one-ton vehicles with a tank on the back, drinking water. And one of these vehicles came up, and he took the wrong turning and was heading straight towards the German lines. He had lights on, but the lights had been blanked out, so they were very small, but he had lights on. And he was moving towards the German lines, and they opened up on him. It's in the middle of the night. They opened up on him with machine gun fire and hit the vehicle. The people driving it got away, but the vehicle was left standing in the middle of no man's land. The following morning at light, I was told that I had to put my toolbox on my shoulder, leave my rifle, put a toolbox on my shoulder, and walk casually down to this truck and get it back. They didn't send a recovery vehicle down, because if they sent a recovery vehicle down, they might fire on that one. They said, as long as you're walking down and they can see you, because they said they'll be watching with binos, he said they won't shoot you. I'd have liked a guarantee on that, but I felt scared as hell, actually. 19-year-old with a toolbox on my shoulder, walking, trying to be casually down to a vehicle. Got to it. They had shot up the radiator, and they'd also, around it, hit the distributor cap. And the reason why they couldn't run it. I could have run it back without the water. The water run out. I could have run it back without the water for a short distance if I could have started it. I couldn't start it, of course, with the distributor cap. So I had to walk back and get a spare cap off another vehicle. Walk down again, start it up. I backed it up the way it had come. And that was it. I got the job having to repair it, and it was very, very cold. When I say cold, I mean very, very cold. And I'd been working on this thing altogether, possibly about 14 hours, and I then went to sleep. I just laid down on the ground in a small concrete bunker sort of thing. I laid on the ground, went to sleep. When I woke up, I put my hand on the floor and I couldn't feel anything. I looked at my hand and all my fingers had swollen up and they was touching each other on both hands with a frostbite. I stood up, fell down, my toes were the same way. My feet were like balloons. So obviously I couldn't not think I could do about it. So they sent for a doctor and he came down to have a look at me. And he says, nothing they could do, they'd have to ship me back to number one general hospital, which was at Dieppe. I was shipped out on a French ambulance and put on a French ambulance train with all the rest of people were French on it. And then we did a tour of France. Sounds strange, but it was a tour of France. We were dropping French soldiers off at various towns and put into their local hospitals. And the last person to get off it was myself. And that was round at Dieppe. We came into Dieppe and I was dropped there. The number one general hospital was in the building that was formerly the casino. It was 5 days travelling the train. I'd been fed, and when I say fed, they had to feed me because I couldn't do anything for myself. But they hadn't even washed me because my hands were still greasy. British Hospital, number one general hospital, I was taken there, and it was a Saturday. I was wheeled into a huge ward, which was the main gambling room, and put into a bed. The next bed to one side was empty. It had been someone in it because the sheets were back. On the other side of me, the chappie in bed. I was just dumped there. They came down and washed me up, cleaned me up. I was talking to the chappie at the other side of me. I said, just after we came in, they wheeled one in on one of these gurneys, the wheeled trolleys, and they put him into the bed next to me on the side that was empty. He'd obviously been operated on because he had a tube out of his mouth, probably to allow him to breathe, I suppose. And when he actually started to recover, they took this tube out. They covered over the bottom of his cot with a wire grill. And I asked the chappie, I said, what's the matter with that bloke? And they said, they'd just taken his foot off. I said, what was up? And they said, frostbite. Well, that didn't please me a lot. And not only was there was quite a few in there with frostbite. Some people had had their ear dropped off, and it got brittle and knocked it, and it come adrift. There were soldiers there, quite a lot of them, suffering from frostbite. On the afternoon, a young doctor, army officer, came round and examined me, and he shook his head and said, don't like the look of your toes. Both my big toes were now black. They'd gone black. And he said, we might have to amputate the toes. And he said, but we shan't make any decision tomorrow. The major comes back from leave, and he'll see you in the morning on his rounds. On the Sunday morning, one of the first coincidences of my life, that one of them, the major came to my bed, picked my sheet up at the bottom of the bed and looked at me and said, do I know you? I said, well, you ought to do. You're my doctor in civil life. And he was Dr. Hendry in Halifax. He was at Halifax. He also did operations at the Halifax Infirmary. He must have been on reserve with the medics because he was a major in the medics in the Warren General Hospital. I was quite friendly with him because not only was my family doctor, I also used to repair his car when he used to bring his car into the garage I was working in. I told him I didn't want to lose any bits on my toes, and he said, well, we'll see what we can do. Anyway, he succeeded. And I was up on crutches in about 2 weeks. I made recovery. I still troubled with it. With trouble, every time it gets cold, my fingers go white from the top joint up to the ends, and my toes feel back too. But at the time I had the thing, it was really bad. Nowadays, it doesn't trouble me. But they say you never get rid of it. The doctor told me that what's happening is it breaks down the small veins near the skin, and of course, so it stops, it does the circulation in those joints. When I was fit, the one thing that was interesting, I saw Gracie Fields. She came out with a concert party and did a show for the hospital, and she was excellent. I went in there on crutches, so I had one of the front seats. When they said I was fit enough, I was then sent down to number one general base, which was at Pornichet, at the mouth of, Loire, near Nantes anyway. Nantes is just up the river. Pornichet is right on the estuary. It was on top of a small cliff. We was in boat tents, the large boat tents, 8 men to a boat tent. This is January, and it was bitterly cold. We had no duty to do. All we did was parade once in the morning, and then had to hang around, as it say, till the following morning if we hadn't got a posting, if we hadn't got movement orders. I found that I couldn't sleep. We had two blankets and a palliasse, just a cotton bag full of straw and two blankets. And I just couldn't sleep for the cold. So I worked out a system. I went onto the first parade to make sure I wasn't going anywhere. Then I went to bed and I slept in there with everybody else's blankets on top of me. And I slept all day. And all night I used to go walk round and walk into the guard rooms and have a cup of tea in the guard rooms with the guard commanders. I was still waiting for a posting back to 14th Army Field Workshop. I was getting desperate. I'd been there about 5 days and I wasn't enjoying it. We had a sergeant major. He was a queer character. We called him Blue Nose for the obvious reasons. He had the biggest, bluest nose I've ever seen, and he was an absolute pig. But he called us up one morning and said, "I want volunteers. I want a volunteer vehicle mechanic, first class, to go to infantry." Well, everybody took one pace back, and I took one pace forward. I'd have gone anywhere to get out of the place. They put me on a train, sent me up to the 1st Battalion, the Border Regiment, up near the Belgian frontier. 1st Battalion, the Border Regiment, all regular soldiers, either all serving regulars or reservists called back to the colours. There was five of us, ROC attached to them, and we was all people that had been called in on supplementary C reserve. And there was a sergeant vehicle mechanic, two private vehicle mechanics, a cobbler, because he did all the boots, and an armourer, because he did the weapons, all from the ROC. The rest were border regiment. I was stationed in a small village with the motor transport, very small village. We just had enough room to park the vehicles in the open bottom. We had a lean-to shed where we could do the repairs. We still had no military training whatsoever. I was okay because I knew the vehicles. They kept me busy. And this carried on until the Germans invaded Holland and Belgium. As soon as that happened, the regiment formed up and moved out. Their job was to move into Belgium and to swing round and form a line with the French and the Belgians on the flank. And we was to move forward and join up. I don't know where we were moving to, because we didn't get maps. The only officer had maps. I was in the last vehicle in the convoy because I was the fitter vehicle. So anybody broke down, I had a job of repairing them. I had no idea where I was going. I just followed the convoy. And we was all the same. We just followed the vehicle in front. When he stopped, we stopped. We got to the Belgian frontier. And then, very, very peculiar, Belgium had been invaded. But the Belgians wouldn't let us cross the river into Belgium. They hadn't got the orders from the king. So we was on the south side, the Belgian were on the north side, there's a bridge, they wouldn't let it across. The colonel, our colonel, were absolutely blew his tank, but that was it. They said, no, we can't do it without orders from the king. But they did allow one thing. The Border Regiment had a military band, and it was quite a good band. They allowed the band to cross without weapons. They crossed the bridge, and they did actually beat retreat in Belgium on the evening. And we were watching from the other side of the river. An absolutely ridiculous situation. But that's the army. That's war. And nothing goes according to plan. Anyway, we did get the order to move and went across, and we moved up. Once again, you don't know where you're going. Simply, I'm just in the last vehicle. I'm following them through. And eventually stopped. Food was made, brought back to us. We moved on again. And we finally got into the position we were going to stay on. And we had Belgians on the left flank, the British army in a circle, and I presume the French were down in south on the other flank.
Whereabouts in France had you moved from?
I can show it you on the map. I don't know the name of the place. I can show you. It's a very small village where I was. The regiment, the battalion himself, was split up on a front. There was companies spaced on quite a wide front. So there was no particular town.
Where was it near?
Near, it was to the right of Lille. And south of us was nearest place to south of us was Douai. That was the nearest town to us. To the south, it was Douai. Moved into Belgium, and then the trouble started. On that convoy, I saw my first person killed. The convoys had got mixed up. We got a mixed convoy. Somebody else had broken into us, so we was various vehicles, not just ours, but there was different people moving up on the same road. We had then the trouble with the civilians were coming out, loaded up with their possessions, and were coming out in the opposite direction from us. The Belgian people were moving out of the houses because they were bombing and shelling further ahead of us. We got shot up by a fighter plane. It came down the road, machine gun in the road, and luckily, it can only hit you when it's actually coming down. As soon as it levels out, the rounds go level, and as soon as he pulls up, of course they can't hit you, so he can only hit coming down. And he came up on top of us, didn't hit us, but he hit a truck about four in front of us. And that was the Corps of Transport, it is now, in those days it was the Army Service Corps, hit the truck and killed the driver. He got about five bullets in the back, it had come straight through the cab. We couldn't do anything for him at all. The only thing we had were the first field dressings, which everybody carries, which is a large pad and bandages. We couldn't get him to a doctor because the convoy was stuck there, nose to tail. The Belgian people were passing us, retreating. We got the chap out of his van. We laid him on the tailgate of the wagon, and we just made him as comfortable as we could till he died. It was about my age, and not first person I'd seen, but the first person I'd ever seen shot. It was a bit of a shock for me too. Anyway, we got further up. The battalion went into action. We was back behind the lines with B echelon. B echelon is the part of the regiment that includes the quartermaster, the stores, the supplies, the vehicles. We are slightly behind the regiment. We supplied with this. We supplied when then we send the supplies up to the troops at night. You don't travel in the day because it's too dangerous. And the regiment went into action. I was still 2 or 3 miles behind it. Then we got dive bombed. Dive bombers started to come, and little did we didn't know, but Rommel, General Rommel, had actually broken through to the right flank and was swinging round behind us. The first thing we really knew was when the Russians never came up. We stopped getting supplies because the supplies wasn't reaching us because by the interruption from Rommel's column. We got no food, so we was told to forage, which is another word for looting, really. But the people had left their houses, the stock was still there in the fields, and we were absolutely short of food, and so we was nothing else for us to do but to kill what we could. We found a